are Locked On Seahawks, your daily Seattle Seahawks podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Greetings, 12. This is Corbin Smith, your host for Locked On Seahawks. Joining me as always, my co-host in crime, Rob Rang. Unfortunately, we have our first Misery Monday of the 2021 regular season. And as we'll be discussing, Rob, it was one that we didn't envision we were going to be having today with the way yesterday's game was looking through the first three plus quarters. And unfortunately, a meltdown of historic proportions happened at Lumen Field. So we have to break down that matchup over the last couple or over the next couple of days and dive into what went wrong for the Seahawks. We'll be doing that some today, looking at our takeaways and handing out game balls. Plus, we'll be answering your questions in our weekly mailbag segment. The Locked On NFL Draft Podcast relaunches September 20th with brand new hosts. Eric Crocker brings the player scouting. Ryan Tracy brings the analytics. Follow the Locked On NFL Draft Podcast on YouTube, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get podcasts. Now for your lead story here on Locked On Seahawks. Prior to yesterday's Week 2 game between the Seahawks and the Titans, the Seahawks had never lost a game at home where they were ahead 15 or more points in their franchise history. They were 52-0 going into yesterday. Unfortunately, all streaks are meant to eventually be broken, and that one was broken by the Titans yesterday. A phenomenal comeback by Mike Vrabel's team. And on the flip side, the type of epic meltdown that we just don't see from Pete Carroll coach teams in Seattle. Their main mantra always has been, can you win in the first quarter? Can you win in the second quarter? Can you win in the third quarter? Can you win in the fourth quarter? They want to finish strong, and typically that's what they've done. But they did the polar opposite of that mantra yesterday and gave up 17 unanswered points in the fourth quarter in overtime to fall to 1-1. Now the only team in the NFC West that has lost a game in the first 2 weeks of the season.
Yeah, obviously a very disappointing end to yesterday's game for the Seahawks. As you mentioned, Corbin, I mean, during the peak care, the Seahawks have been absolutely fantastic. When they do have that big lead, and they are able to finish teams. And that obviously was not the case against the Tennessee Titans. I thought the Tennessee Titans were the more physical team, certainly down the stretch. They committed to the running game and stayed at it the way that Pete Carroll has always talked about that he wanted to do. It was just the polar opposite of the Seahawks squad that we saw in the week one victory on the road against Indianapolis. And how everything seemed to be clicking offense, on defense, on special teams. And, you know, I thought for the most part, Seattle played fairly well and certainly played very, very well in the first half against the Tennessee Titans. But there were some weak links on offense, on defense, and on special teams that all contributed, I think, in many ways equally to Seattle's loss. And to me, this was not a game where you just – pin all the blame on one player, one of the three different realms of football. I thought this, as much as it was a collective win for the Seahawks against the Colts, I thought this absolutely was a collective loss, and one that the Seahawks have to get rectified quickly, because this is going to become the MO of how to stop the Seahawks is be able to run the ball right down their throat. That's got to just make Pete Carroll gag.
Yeah, he was really upset after the game. And I, quite frankly, I don't know that I've ever seen him so depressed after a loss. And it's understandable because, again, this is not the type of loss that the Seahawks typically have with Pete Carroll on the sidelines. I mean, they finished games strong. That's always been the way things have been. Last year, especially, all those close games, they always found a way, it seemed like, to be able to pull those games out. The one exception was the road game against the Arizona Cardinals. This game felt very similar. I mean, not obviously the Cardinals did a lot of different things than what the Titans did to get back in this football game, but just from the sense that early in the fourth quarter, it's 30-16. The Seahawks have a 14-point lead. They just scored on one of the worst busted coverages I have ever seen in an NFL game on a 68-yard touchdown from Russell Wilson to Freddie Swain. All the momentum that had swung back to the visitors was now back on the home sideline. But only for a few minutes before Derrick Henry struck with a 60-yard touchdown. And as you mentioned, there's blame to pass around here. The coaching staff deserves some blame. The defense deserves blame. The offense deserves blame. For this particular episode, though, I'm going to pick on the offense because I was waiting for Shane Waldron to pull his face off and it to be Brian Schottenheimer on the sidelines, because this game felt like the second half of the 2020 season for the Seahawks on offense. It was an all or nothing approach pretty much the entire day. The only exception was an incredible 2-minute drill drive that they had inside a minute to play at the end of the first half. That drive, they were able to roll down the field. I believe it was 48 seconds that they got a touchdown, and Russell Wilson just marched them right down the field, perfect tempo, in rhythm. That was the only drive they had in the entire game that was like that, because they had a quick touchdown off of a fumble recovery by Kerry Hyder, and then they had two other touchdown drives that were aided by big plays. And so it was an all or nothing situation for the Seahawks. If they were not getting those explosive plays downfield, they were seeing a lot of those two deep safety looks again. They were not taking advantage of the short to intermediate passing game, in particular the middle of the field. Rob, they had three first downs the entire second half and overtime. And the final drive they had in overtime was an absolute disaster. Came out and just a couple throws deep down the sidelines to Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf that didn't have a chance to get completed. And then Russell Wilson tried to do too much, probably should have been flagged for a safety there for throwing the ball out on intentional grounding, and they decided that he had the ball at the 1-yard line. It was just a disaster of a possession. So, yes, the defense did not play well down the stretch. They couldn't stop Derrick Henry. Their run gap fits were a problem. But I'm going to pin this one to the offense if I have to pick a side, because, again, you scored 24 points the first half, and then you scored just 6 that were gifted to you again by that busted coverage. Otherwise, they did nothing on the offensive side of the football. With Russell Wilson under center, the weapons they have, there's no excuse for that.
No, I 100% agree with you. There is absolutely no excuse for that. I mean, I agree with one of the things that you said there, as far as that you thought that Shane Waldron had basically morphed into Brian Schottenheimer or Darrell Bevell before him. I wanted to look at the calendar and say, is this October? We got Halloween already. You know, what's the deal here? Because that's what it felt like. It felt like basically it was Russell Wilson throwing a deep ball for a 60-yard touchdown, or you're going to be punting in 3 plays. And that was basically all that happened there. There was absolutely no continuity of their offense. The Tennessee Titans, they did what I think that the Seahawks wanted to do. They matriculated their way down the field, slow, steady, using the clock. Even when Seattle did score, it was so quick with the 60-yard plus touchdowns to Tyler Lockett and another 60-yard plus touchdown to Freddie Swain, as you mentioned, just a colossal breakdown in coverage from Tennessee's standpoint. Those felt like fluky plays to me from Seattle's offense, whereas Tennessee basically took it to Seattle from the entire game, the entire game. And so that's one of the reasons why, as a follower of the Seahawks, as somebody who wants to see Seattle do well, I wasn't at all surprised by the way that this game turned out, because, again, it did feel very fluky from Seattle's perspective, whereas Tennessee, I thought, basically controlled a lot of this game from the outset. Had it not been for Julio Jones being ruled out, for that safety, I thought it was a safety for Russell. I mean, Tennessee could have basically just pants Seattle in their own building. They certainly played the more consistent football for the 65-plus minutes or so of that game.
Yeah, that's debatable, because the first half, the Seahawks were able to make stops when they needed to. But again, Julio Jones just barely out. I still think that was a touchdown, to be honest with you. But there were a bunch of plays that really went the Seahawks' way, whether it was coverage breakdowns or calls during the game. And they were not able to fully capitalize on a lot of those opportunities. So it ended up coming back to bite them. Real quick before we get to our mailbag, just to put in perspective, Rob, how bad the Seahawks were after that Freddie Swain touchdown early in the fourth quarter. Their last 4 possessions, 3 plays, 8 yards, 3 plays, 9 yards, 4 plays, 42 yards. And most of those were a dump off to Tyler Lockett with time running out. They were garbage yards. And then overtime, 3 plays, negative 12 yards. 3 of those ended with a punt, and the other one was the end of the game going into overtime. You cannot win games against a quality football team when you can't finish. And clearly, those four drives illustrate the Seahawks did anything but finish this contest. So I'm sure that won't be the last that we talk about this particular topic, because it was a big part of Seattle losing this game, the offensive ineptitude down the stretch. But we're going to get to our mailbag questions coming up here in the second quarter. Tons of questions from the 12s. Not all of them are nasty fire Pete Carroll or what's wrong with Russell Wilson type questions. So we're going to tackle as many questions as we can coming up when we return. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Hey, Seahawks fans, this is Corbin Smith with an incredible app everyone who buys gas needs to know about. Get Upside. My listeners are making up to 25 cents for every gallon of gas every time they fill up. Just download the free Get Upside app in the App Store or Google Play right now. Use promo code TOUCHDOWN and get a bonus 25 cents per gallon on your first fill up. That's up to 50 cents cash back. Don't pay full price of the pump anymore. Get cash back at Get Upside. Just download the app for free and use the promo code TOUCHDOWN to get up to 50 cents per gallon cash back on your first tank. Some people who drive a lot, such as myself, are making as much as $200 to $300 a month in cash back, and there's no catch. The cash back gets added right to your account. You can cash out anytime to your bank account, PayPal, or an e-gift card for Amazon and other brands. Just download the free Get Upside app and use promo code TOUCHDOWN to get up to 50 cents per gallon cash back on your first tank. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast. I'm your host, Corbin Smith. Joining me as always, Rob Rang. It's Misery Monday here on the podcast. First time in the regular season that the Seahawks fell loser in their own stadium. It was an ugly finish against the Tennessee Titans. We'll get to more on that in the third quarter when we discuss some of our takeaways and hand out game balls for week two. But first, it's time to tackle your questions in our weekly mailbag segment. First one here coming from Tom Dean tweets, how concerning are the silly penalties we are giving away at crucial times in games? Seems to be a lack of discipline amongst some players. I know, Rob, after the game that Pete Carroll kept mentioning that over and over again in his responses. You could tell how irked he was by those penalties, and that continued on Monday. That really was a big part of allowing Tennessee to get back into this football game.
No, I think it was absolutely a critical part of it. I think just in the penalty yards, you know, Seattle had 10 penalties for 100 yards. Tennessee had 5 for 45. So obviously Seattle is giving away half of a football field, you know, just in free yards there. And to me, and this back to the listener's question, and thank you as always to all of our listeners for their questions, Tom Dean in this case. I agree with what Tom Dean is suggesting here. It seems to be a lack of discipline among some players, and that is where I have the bigger concern for the Seattle moving forward. You do have some freakishly athletic players, but I think sometimes they buy into their own talent, their own physicality, their own aggression, and that's easy to have some of these over-aggressive penalties. I don't think it's something that the head coach or any of the positional coaches need to focus on so much of their attention and then, you know, lose what you normally would be focusing in on. And Pete Carroll talked about during his Monday presser that basically he has to do a better job. They do so much to try and get these players so fired up that sometimes can get taken, maybe out of context, or they can take it too far. I thought specifically with the DJ Reed penalty for taunting that with DK Metcalf a couple of different times, of his physicality in terms of holding and blocks and things like that, the Jordan Brooks penalty as well. These are talking about some of your absolute best players, but I think that sometimes they allow that aggression to get out of control. It reminds me of the Pete Carroll days back with the USC Trojans, and sometimes they would have mistakes. I think you can have these types of mistakes and still play good aggressive football, but when you're playing a team as talented as the Tennessee Titans are, where the margin is as slim as they are, then giving away half of a football field, missing a single PAT, those are the kind of things that can send you home with a loss.
Yeah, the penalties definitely were a big part of Tennessee being able to overcome a 15-point halftime deficit, a 14-point deficit early in the fourth quarter. The Seahawks gave them extended possessions on several instances, but I don't know that I would call this a hot take necessarily. I don't think that the penalties, even though they had 10 for 100 yards, I don't think the penalties were as big of a deal as the fact that the offense just had no rhythm in the second half and that the defense suddenly started to struggle with gap integrity and handling their assignments, issues they didn't have in the first half on either side of the ball. Really, on offense, rhythm was tough to come by the entire game, but they did have some good drives in the second quarter. They were able to put up 21 points, 14 of those coming on decent possessions. But my point is, you look at the penalties they had, the taunting one of DJ Reed, the Titans didn't get any points in that. They stopped him on fourth down a few plays later. The penalty that they called in Jamal Adams for roughing the passer in overtime, they still got the Titans to punt. Now, they would have had to punt without that penalty, and the Seahawks would have had better starting position. Maybe that changes the way that their first possession in overtime goes, but we will never know. My point is, really, aside from the Jordan Brooks penalty and the Damian Lewis penalty where he had a false start on fourth and one, I think the Seahawks would have gone for that. And Pete Carroll said so this morning, in fact, that they would have gone for it there to get that 1 yard and really ice the game. They weren't able to do that with the false start pushing them back to fourth and six. Now you absolutely have to punt. You have no other choice. So that penalty in Jordan Brooks, I don't know what he was thinking of that play, and I don't think Pete Carroll understood either. That's why he benched him for two drives after that. He was sending a message. We don't make silly mistakes like that where we ride a tight end 10 yards out of bounds and then throw him to the ground. You're going to get busted and flagged every single time that you do that. So there were certainly some critical penalties in this game. I just don't know that it was as big of a reason for this epic collapse as some of the other factors that really, in my mind, played a bigger role in the Titans being able to overcome that deficit and eventually win in overtime. Rain tweets, what is Pete Carroll's deal with stressing Trey Flowers' development when he's shown absolutely no improvement? You know, it's you and I are both like this back and forth. Is Trey Flowers finally turning the corner? Is Trey Flowers a guy that, you know, we know who he is. It's time to move on.
I am. I also am going to give a credit to Ryan Tannehill. You know, he's a quarterback out there that a lot of people just say, oh, yeah, Ryan Tannehill, he's okay. I mean, this is a quarterback who has absolutely developed into, you know, at least in my opinion, one of the better ones in the league. And he's throwing to two absolute superstars. In the case of Julio Jones, a future Hall of Famer, and AJ Brown is, you know, I think a consistent Pro Bowler and perhaps on the cusp of a spectacular, perhaps Hall of Fame career. So I certainly would give some credit there. At the same time, there's no question that Trey Flowers was beaten a couple of times, and it certainly felt like that Tannehill was looking to that side of the field and, for the most part, ignoring DJ Reed's side of the field, at least early on. I thought the Trey Flowers kind of came back and played pretty well down the stretch. I also thought that he was, again, as he often is Seattle's best tackling run-defending cornerback. Unfortunately, and we're going to talk about this a little bit more as we go, that the gap integrity, some of the just – by gap integrity, we mean, of course, holding up the point of attack and having your lane. But I thought things that Seattle tried to do defensively was very similar to what we saw offensively. They were so super aggressive with some of their pursuit angles. They'd rush so far upfield, get Derrick Henry moving outside or cutting back inside, and that worked in the first quarter. But when Seattle started to tire, then that's really where Henry was able to kind of do some off-tackle plays and really break to the outside. And so to me, that is one thing you have to make sure that you are including anytime you are going to evaluate Trey Flowers or any other corner that in that regard. Trey Flowers does get beat in coverage. There's no question about it. But again, his ability to play in the run, I thought, was one of the reasons why Seattle did have the success that they had, at least in the first half against Derrick Henry. And I would go back to the last week as well against Jonathan Taylor and the Colts also.
Yeah, Flowers ended up giving up 4 receptions for 102 yards, most of that coming in the first half to Julio Jones, who had 3 catches for 87 yards going up against Flowers. He beat him on a 51-yarder. It was a double move. Looked like Jones was going to go outside, and then he worked back upfield, and that was just enough for him to create separation. And again, Julio Jones is one of the best receivers to ever play the game, one of the better generations of this, or one of the better receivers of this era. And so for him to do that against Flowers, that's not really something that should be held against Flowers, because we're talking about such a big-time talent. But at the same time, there are the issues of consistency and the fact that we haven't seen the improvement and the fact that that 60-yard touchdown by Derrick Henry, Trey Flowers was that last line of defense there, and he was not able to get a hand on Derrick Henry there, allowing him to get to full speed, and that it's game over. Once that 245-pound freight train's going downhill, he is going to find his way to the end zone. So overall, was not an impressive performance. There's a reason that Pete Carroll, you know, gave a pretty non-glowing review today of his cornerbacks in general. He's, when he's asked how he thought he played, he said they're battling. That's usually code word, well, they're out there, I guess. He's not overly happy with the way that the corners are playing, and I could see a change coming there at some point. So Flowers has been put back on notice, and he lost his starting job before last year. So, I mean, they have given him chance after chance, and you're just not seeing the play carry over from how he looked in training camp. It just isn't carrying over into the regular season. And they have a couple other corners like Sidney Jones they may want to give a chance. And so I think we're heading that direction where they could make a change at some point here in the near future if Trey Flowers is not able to turn things around and play a lot better than he did yesterday. Matthew Blue tweets, two-part question. Why do you think Russell Wilson still has an issue throwing to the middle of the field? Do you think the lack of tight end usage against the Titans was down to the play calls or Wilson's reluctance to use or not use them or not seeing them? Those are really good questions, Rob, especially because I know you and I, before the show, were both talking about, lamenting about the fact that Seattle didn't get Gerald Everett and Will Disley involved at all in this game.
Absolutely at all. I mean, that was one of the things that really did shock me. Again, considering how well that Seattle utilized their tight ends, how well both of them played against the Colts. You know, Gerald Everett getting the touchdown, Will Disley kind of using his own little kind of get off me kind of physicality. And I thought the Tennessee Titans, with the fact that they have, you know, basically a 3-4 front, a lot of times rushing their edge linebackers upfield. And while they do have terrific safeties at the same time, I thought that this was a defense that would be vulnerable to that. At the same time, I did not see many plays that I felt like were specifically targeting the tight end. Obviously, Russell Wilson has to make whatever decision he wants with the football. And that's ultimately where I'm going to put some blame here. And this is, I don't know that blame is the right word for this. I think that Russell Wilson, as we talked about so many times, Corbin, is absolutely a phenomenal player. But I think that the one area in which his height does limit him a little bit is throwing right over the middle. I think that he is able to move back a little bit more and get a different perspective, throwing towards the sidelines, throwing deep. But I think right over the middle, especially when you have taller centers, which is one of the reasons why I've argued that Seattle should consider shorter interior offensive linemen, as well as when you are, you know, when you have tight ends that are constantly in motion the way that Seattle likes to use their tight ends, like with Everett. I do think that makes it that much more difficult for him to throw balls over the top, at least a little bit more so than some of the bigger, taller quarterbacks that are out there. So to me, this has been an issue throughout Russell Wilson's career. I don't know that it necessarily is going to change anytime soon, but I also think that Seattle can do a much better job of manufacturing touches for a tight end, certainly one as athletic as Gerald Everett.
Yeah, I was really surprised. And in fact, I had the tight ends down as a matchup that I thought the Seahawks could absolutely exploit this Titans defense. And yet, as you mentioned, it didn't really seem like there were any plays that were being designed to get the football to Gerald Everett or Will Disley. And I'm not even saying they necessarily need to do that because they are complementary pieces to DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett. But it did feel, again, like Russell Wilson was really trying to force the issue, getting the ball to his two star players on the outside. And sometimes those plays simply were not there. Take your dump offs, take your check downs to your tight ends. You have a good athlete now at the position, Gerald Everett, and yet he had one target. Will Disley didn't get targeted one time in this entire game. And I do think the middle of the field in short to intermediate game, that is truly a flaw in Russell Wilson's game at this point. A lot of people have speculated that for years. Is this really a real issue for him? It absolutely is. And he has found ways to work around it, but smart teams on defense are capitalizing on the fact that they know, you know what, there might be receivers getting open in the middle of the field, short to intermediate, but he's not going to make those throws a lot of the time. And maybe part of it because he can't see it being open. That is the reality of having a 5'10" quarterback. Those plays are going to be missed. Now, there's some of them where you're thinking Wilson had to see that guy, and he just isn't willing to make those throws. So it is a problem. It was a problem all the second half last year. It's been a problem at times earlier in his career. And so I don't know that there's necessarily a fix for that. And, you know, maybe Shane Waldron can scheme it up to be able to get him to throw some more passes in the middle of the field like that. But I think there are always going to be some limitations there. You can work around it, but it certainly doesn't help in terms of being the play caller, especially when you're playing too high safety looks and you can't run the football. You add those two things together, then suddenly it gets pretty tough to be able to get those downfield throws. And so they're going to have to continue to see if they can find ways to improve attacking the middle of the field. I just think, again, that's going to be something that's going to be limited a little bit for Russell Wilson for the entirety of his career, in part because of his height. That is just the reality. When we come back in the third quarter, we're going to continue breaking down our takeaways from Sunday's 33-30 loss to the Titans, and we'll be handing out our weekly game balls. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Do you know that Built Bar has 9 delicious flavors, plus the occasional limited time flavor? If you talk to a Built Bar fan like myself, we're definitely passionate about our favorites. If you don't know the Built Bar flavors, you're certainly missing out, whether it's raspberry, mint brownie, my favorite peanut butter brownie, double chocolate, salted caramel. There are so many delicious flavors to choose from. If you haven't had all the flavors, you can get a mixed box where you'll get 2 of each of the 9 flavors. Not only are Built Bar flavors the best tasting, but they're absolutely healthy too. 17 grams of protein, only 130 calories, 4 grams of sugar, and only 4 grams net carbs. 9 amazing flavors, all tasty, all healthy. Make sure to go to BuiltBar.com and use the code LOCKED15 to get 15% your order. That's at BuiltBar.com. Does this sound familiar? You've got one device that lets you catch the game live, another that lets you stream your favorite shows. You're watching sports highlights on your phone, and you've got your neighbor's best friend's login for the good stuff. Well, I want to tell you about a simple way to get all the entertainment you love without the hassle, and a great way to finally get your TV together. It's called DirecTV Stream, and it brings your live TV and on-demand favorites together like never before, so you can watch your favorite sports, movies, and shows all in one place. That means no more juggling remotes, and no need to buy another device again. And the best part, there's no annual contract. So get rid of the clutter and the confusion and get your TV together with DirecTV Stream. You can learn more at DirecTV.com. That's DirecTV.com. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, Monday edition. I'm your host, Corbin Smith, joined as always by Rob Rang. The Seahawks were in control for most of their Week 2 contest against the Tennessee Titans. They had a 24-9 lead at halftime. They were up 30-16 with a little over 13 minutes to go in the fourth quarter, and yet they were not able to finish. They weren't able to hold on to that lead. The Titans scored 17 unanswered points in the fourth quarter in overtime to steal the win at Lumen Field. Certainly not the way Seahawks coaches and players were wanting to treat the fans in their first game back at the stadium since 2019. Going into this game, they were so fired up about finally being able to play in front of the 12s, and it was a disheartening finish to not be able to come away with a win in a game that really the Seahawks dominated for a good chunk of.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that it reminded me of so many Seahawks games I used to go to as a kid growing up and going to college, you know, in college. And I mentioned college and kind of the, when I say as a kid, kind of the adult kid days, because I remember, Corbin, plenty of games where Seattle would have a nice little lead, and then that crowd that had been so raucous, to use the word that they kept saying over and over again during the telecast. And certainly the 12s were very loud. But they also kind of take their time, or at least I did back in those days. You go to halftime and you're feeling so good about yourself, and you maybe have a sip or two, and then you kind of work your way back into the game, the third and fourth quarter, and you know, you kind of lose that same momentum. And I thought the 12s did that a little bit, and certainly the Seahawks did a little bit. And to me, that would be one of the absolute takeaways I'd have with this game, is just that for a team that, and a head coach who's always prided himself on being able to finish, I don't know, when we start talking about game balls, we might be talking about, you know, Roger in the 300 section that was maybe one of the janitors cleaning up, because they might have been the only ones affiliated with the Seahawks who actually finished the job at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's difficult to look at the way this game finished and come up with positives, just because when you control the line of scrimmage the way the Seahawks did for most of the first half, and you were able to hit on a number of explosive plays, and you are able to create a turnover that leads to points. The things that the Seahawks did, a lot of more things that we are accustomed to seeing from the Seahawks when they are successful. And for them to just have everything fall apart the way that did, just nothing went right after that Freddie Swain touchdown. They couldn't move the ball on offense. They couldn't get the stops they needed on defense for the most part. And Derrick Henry was just too much to handle. And this just kind of goes back to the whole idea. You know, you have some of these people that laugh when you mention the idea of body blows. And I think sometimes that term is overused. But when you're talking about Derrick Henry, it absolutely is a factor. When you have to tackle him 35-plus times in a game, that is going to demoralize a defense, especially when he starts busting some big runs. They were able to keep the dam upright in the first half. Once he busted that one, the dam was completely broke open, and then they couldn't repair their run defense. They just were in trouble the rest of the game. And so it was unfortunate that it unfolded that way, but they had their gap integrity issues. They had some bad pursuit angles, and they were just exhausted. I mean, in the second half, there was, I believe, a 20-minute discrepancy for the entire game, and most of that was in the second half, the time of possession. Some of it's because Seattle couldn't get first downs on offense, but, I mean, the Titans just were grinding out these long drives. Aside from Henry's 60-yard run, they were having these long double-digit play drives just grinding it out, and that really wears down a defense. But let's talk some positives, because, you know, when you lose by 3 points and you score 30 points on the scoreboard, you get a defensive turnover that leads to a touchdown. I mean, there are a lot of positives in this game, even though it's really hard to talk about them because of the final outcome. But I want to call out the defensive line in the interior, because I thought the defensive tackles played outstanding football for the Seahawks in this game, because Derrick Henry was having most of his success rushing off tackle in this football game. When he was trying to run into the teeth of Seattle's defense, he was having to deal with Al Woods, Puna Ford, and even Robert Kendiche. I thought Robert Kendiche had some nice tackles in this game, his first game since 2019. I thought all three of those players brought their hard hats in the run game. Bobby Wagner was getting downhill, making plays. He had 20 tackles on the afternoon. So running between the tackles late, they were able to find a little more success. But for the most part, Seattle really had Henry bottled up. And Ford and Woods both had quarterback hits. Woods had a sack in this game. So those interior guys weren't just stuffing the run. They were also providing the little bit of pass rush that the Seahawks had in this football game. Most of that pressure was coming from the interior. So I thought those guys played fantastic football for the Seahawks up front.
I would mention that, you know, Wagner, as you noted, had 20 tackles in this game. Absolutely spectacular. 16 of those being solo stops. I mean, that's twice as many as anybody else for Tennessee or for Seattle. So I think that certainly is a positive. We want to get specific about, say, a defensive player. Offensively, how do you not, you know, highlight Tyler Lockett and the fact that he goes for 170 and a plus and another touchdown? So again, they're definitely were some positives in terms of individual players. I think another positive is the fact that this game, this loss, happened as early as it did. And it certainly is going to help the Seahawks get the attention of some of their young superstars. And I think that it helps them reinforce just how critical it is. Again, if you are going to be playing against a very good team, which the Tennessee Titans clearly are, then the margin for error is absolutely minuscule. And if you start playing these kind of showboaty kind of plays where it's all about the individuals rather than the team concept of defense, that's what I thought really broke down. Sure, just the physicality that is Derrick Henry, 35 rushing attempts, plus he caught 5 passes, a career high in this game. Again, I think the Tennessee basically said, look, as we talked about before the game, Corbin, that Derrick Henry was priority number one, number two, whatever. The Tennessee Titans recognized that as well. And they just gave the ball to King Henry and let him do his work. And to see the way that Henry was able to put the team on his shoulders and literally be able to carry the Seahawks, you know, into a loss, to me, that is exactly what Seattle has to kind of gravitate towards, that type of mentality. Chris Carson can be that guy for the Seahawks. He had his 2 rushing touchdowns as well. But the fact that Seattle didn't continue to run the football down the stretch, Alex Collins gets one rushing attempt. Travis Homer doesn't get any attempts, but he makes a couple of plays as a receiver. Continue to use your running backs. It's not just the DK Metcalf, Tyler Lockett, Russell Wilson show. There is a lot of other players on that offense that really could have helped Seattle be able to move the chains, score a little bit more points, and have left Lumen Field with a victory.
And I'm going to mention this here in a moment. Real quick, I want to call out one more positive. I don't know that Duane Brown has ever played better than what I've seen him play these first two games. Who needs training camp if you're going to play the way that he has? He has not given up a single pressure in these first two games. I thought he was the only offensive lineman that was consistently able to get the job done opening up running lanes yesterday. They got a couple nice blocks from Gabe Jackson and Damian Lewis, but Duane Brown was playing outstanding football throughout the game. And the fact that they have not extended him at this point, I wonder what John Schneider's thinking now, because we're two games into the season and clearly he is not showing signs of slowing down. He is still playing at a Pro Bowl, borderline All-Pro caliber level as the blindside protector, so invaluable for that offensive line playing the most important position in the trenches. And so kudos to him for coming in phenomenal shape, even not having training camp, shown no signs of rust. You can tell he's a seasoned veteran that was fully prepared, and he's played outstanding. Now, let's get to the negatives here, and I don't want to spend too much time on this because, you know, we could sit here and say doom and gloom stuff all day long. But the thing that bothered me the most in this football game, I mentioned in the first quarter, this was kind of that welcome to the NFL moment for Shane Waldron. And I felt like a lot of the things that made his offense click in Indianapolis were not present. Now, maybe it's because you didn't have D. Eskridge and you weren't confident in being able to run some of the jet motion stuff with Freddie Swain or Tyler Lockett. Maybe that shrunk your playbook a little bit. I still think you can run that stuff with the two receivers that I mentioned. And Penny Hart can do it too. Use Penny Hart. He was available. I thought this offense was extremely stagnant. There wasn't much pre-snap motion. There was a lot of 4 or 5 wide receiver sets. Again, the tight ends, when they're out there, weren't being utilized in the passing game. It didn't seem like they were scheming to get those players involved either. Pete Carroll acted like, well, that's just the way it played out. But they weren't able to get their tight ends involved. And the offensive balance wasn't there. And I think some of it had to do with the fact they weren't able to get that pre-snap motion going with their run game like they did the week before. Again, you don't just motion to motion. It's not just for the sake of having a guy run back and forth. There is a purpose to it. But it just felt like this week, that was not part of the game plan. They weren't trying to incorporate those wrinkles that made this offense fun the week before. And like I said, it looked like Brian Schottenheimer's offense. I don't know if Pete Carroll got involved. I don't think that was the case, but it just looked like the end of 2020. And so I was kind of sitting there in the press box like, okay, where is the offense that we saw? What happened to it? It's like in 1 week, it just disappeared. And again, it's just one game, but that was a little bit disheartening seeing that some of the things that made this offense look different last week were suddenly not visible. They weren't out there.
Oh, I would agree. And I would also say, Locked On Seahawks fans, make sure you listen to tomorrow's show as well. We're going to be breaking down the defense. As we talked about, there is plenty of blame to go around. Carlos Dunlap, where were you? Daryl Taylor, where were you? You're going against backup offensive tackles now. You're going against in front of that Seahawks, that raucous crowd. Where were you? You cannot allow Ryan Tannehill to have 40 dropbacks, and you hit him a couple of times, most of those coming off of blitzes.
All right, closing out the show, it's time real quick, Rob, for us to hand out our game balls. I already mentioned this player's name a moment ago. I could easily go with Tyler Lockett with the monster effort that he had, but that would be too easy to go. I've got to go with the big fella in the trenches because the Titans were locked down for a half running the football when they were trying to run between the tackles. And a big reason for that was Al Woods. He had 7 tackles in this game, a tackle for loss and a sack. He did a little bit of everything for this defense, and it forced the Titans to make some adjustments. And unfortunately, those adjustments were pretty effective against the Seahawks in the second half, running more off tackle. And that allowed them to avoid some of these big fellows like Al Woods in the middle. But I thought Woods was, from quarter one to the end of the game, I thought that he was the most consistent, outstanding performer for the Seahawks on either side of the football. I could not stop watching big number 99 wrecking havoc in the middle of the offensive line.
Yeah, that was certainly one of the highlights. I mentioned before Bobby Wagner, he got my game ball defensively after the first week against the Colts. I thought it was even better against the Tennessee Titans. Certainly were some that he gave up. There were some of those tackles were yards down the field, but I thought that he had the warrior mentality that, frankly, I was missing from the Seahawks.
Betting on the NFL doesn't have to be a guessing game if you listen to the new Locked On Bets podcast hosted by your boy Q and handicapping expert Lee Sterling. Get daily picks, blowout specials, wrong team favorite picks, and Lee Sterling's lock of the day. Follow the Locked On Bets podcast brought to you by betonline.ag. Wherever you get podcasts, you can follow me on Twitter, Corbin Smith NFL. You can follow Rob at Rob Rang. Make sure to check out Locked On Seahawks on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and the all-new Odyssey app. That's AUDACY. When we come back for our Tuesday episode, it's Throwback Tuesday. We'll be looking back at the last several meetings between the Seahawks and the Vikings. All of them recently happened at Lumen Field, but that is going to change this weekend. The Seahawks are finally traveling to Minnesota. The Vikings are going to be really happy about that. So we'll be looking back at the last several matchups between those two NFC rivals. And, of course, we'll be pulling back the curtain and checking out what's new with the Vikings here in the 2021 season. Thanks for listening in. Enjoy the rest of your Monday. Go Hawks.